This is Autoline After Hours with Gary Vaslash and John McElroy, episode 422 for June 1st, 2018. The Electric Future of the Internal Combustion Engine. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or on YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Well, thank you for joining us today. John is at the Mackinac Policy Conference, an annual event that is up on Mackinac Island, and he's taking care of business up there. So you get me today. But you just don't get me. You get Greg Migliori.
That's it.
See, I practiced it, and it just didn't come out right.
Who's Migliori. It's a good smooth one.
Editor-in-chief of Autoblog.com.
That's me.
So this is your debut on the show, I think.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. Do it live.
It
should be fun.
And we have that wily veteran, Lindsay Brook, from SAE's Automotive Engineering.
Nice to be here.
How are you doing?
Thanks for having me. I'm doing great.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Perfect. So we got this car guy, and we got this engineering guy to talk to our special guest, Brian McKay, who is the director of powertrain at Continental North America.
Hey, great to be here.
Thanks for joining us.
That's my pleasure.
So, okay, explain to us, first of all, what your sphere of attention is applied to on a daily basis.
So I'm notorious for being a person that can't focus on a single topic. And I think that's kind of really fits really well with my job. So within powertrain for Continental, we have such a breadth of different technology that I go everywhere from combustion to micromobility to electric propulsion. And then my favorite topic is how connectivity and automated driving meet electrification and really the future of mobility services.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really focus. I jump around and I have a lot of fun doing that.
Okay, so you said combustion, okay? So talk to us about the future of combustion going forward. Does it have a future?
Yeah, we see it having a long future. Where the focus of the attention is bringing additional efficiency to the table. That's one thing, because we're trying to bring not only fuel economy and address greenhouse gas, but really the primary focus after we address that is the focus is on tailpipe pollutant emissions. So things like hydrocarbons, particulate matter, nitrous oxides, and really marrying the combustion system, making sure we burn every single hydrocarbon that's in there in the most optimal ways possible. That's where all the focus and attention is. How do we get the most energy out of that system, but also make that tailpipe nice and clean?
Mm-hmm.
And if we're able to do that, and there's a lot of technologies that we're working on to enable that in the future, the combustion engine will still find its place in the market. Certainly electrification is going to extend that even more, because we have a very efficient way to deliver power with liquid transportation fuels, but certainly batteries, technology, electric motors are the future, but it's a complementary future.
So you think there's a possibility of putting these two things together, which perhaps explains your visual aids here?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as we look towards really all the way to 2030, 2035, we still see 60% of the market being combustion-based. So that's pure internal combustion engine as well as hybrid systems. And the difference when we start talking about hybrid systems is there's not a one-size-fits-all situation. So what I brought with me today is a 48-volt mild hybrid system. So we have 48-volt. We also have 400-volt electrification systems. And we're actually even exploring things like 800-volt systems, which you'll see sooner than later.
So what does that do?
So this specifically is a belt starter generator, or some can call it a motor generator unit. And this particular one here replaces the alternator inside your vehicle, which is really run on a 12-volt system today. So we drop that alternator out and we put this in there, and it has a nice pulley system up front. So it connects to your front end and accessory drive. And what we do is we add a 48-volt battery system, lithium ion, and this belt starter generator, and we're able to crank up the engine to enable things like engine stop start. But it also, because it's really powerful in this case, this one is 15 kilowatts. It provides 50 newton meters of torque right at that pulley. And with the belt ratio, 150 newton meters of torque. So not only can we start and crank the engine very fast, around 100, 150 milliseconds, but we could actually apply torque directly from this machine to assist the engine. But where the fuel economy benefit comes in is during not only during the torque assist, but also during regeneration. So this allows for regenerative braking, and we're able to harness some of that energy from the road, from the mass of the vehicle, and put it back into the battery system so we can continuously do it over and over and over again.
So it starts the car or truck or crossover, and it also applies torque that turns the wheels?
Well, so not directly. So in this particular case, this is attached to the front accessory drive, so it's complementary to adding torque to the crankshaft of the engine. And that, of course, is going to transfer it to the transmission, which will drive torque to the wheels. In other cases, you could actually put in this motor generator unit in different configurations. So we can add it between the engine and the transmission, and right in the middle. We call that a P2 configuration. In other sense, we can actually scale this thing up, make it a larger, more powerful machine, and put it right onto the drive axle and actually drive the vehicle slowly, in a sense. So things like parking maneuvers are definitely possible, and doing that all electrically with a machine that's actually even smaller than this.
Mm-hmm. Lindsay, you looked at this stuff very carefully. What's your take on this sort of technology?
Well, Brian, tell me if I'm wrong. I mean, I see these systems, 48-volt hybrid systems, as being kind of delivering 80% of the bang of a 300-volt or more pure electric system for maybe 20% of the buck. I mean, just in rough terms. I mean, this does all the things you say, but it doesn't have the burden of many hundreds of pounds of battery to lug around. And it also, like you said, it has the flexibility to position it where the OEM wants it. If you've got a front drive car, if you've got an all-wheel drive car. My question is are you seeing a lot of interest in North America for 48-volt systems? We've been told that Europe and the first ones have come from Europe. How are North American automakers looking at this technology?
Yeah, that's, you know, the really exciting thing about this particular technology is the fact that it's so flexible. The mounting locations, but the fact that it's small, it's relatively simple relative to a high voltage system where more safety considerations go into effect. But the beauty of the system is that it's scalable. So it works on a small compact vehicle, which maybe is more common in places like Europe, but this will size all the way to a pickup truck. And in North America, we're really excited because we're actually going to get an opportunity to experience this in the very near future. So FCA has decided to launch 48-volt mild hybrids. It's quite well known really here in the near term on two very common platforms, the Jeep Wrangler and the Dodge Ram pickup truck. And we're very excited about that because it's going to give the American population their first experience in a very common vehicle, ubiquitous vehicle that's all over the road. And I think they'll feel the difference. So I think they'll feel, I like to kind of call this an American-sized stop-start system. It's going to be smooth. It's going to be quiet. And it's going to be a difference when a Dodge Ram maybe pulls up at the stoplight and restarts the engine, and then you have another vehicle there that's slowly starting up and making a bunch of noise.
So that's the e-torque system, as they call it, but it's actually that.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And this machine is scalable, so in theory, you can make them smaller, more compact. You can make them more powerful. You can do air-cooled. In this case, this is a liquid-cooled. In the future, we're even looking at things like hybrid-cooled devices. Mm-hmm. But the most interesting thing is we're really taking all the learnings from the high voltage systems and we're applying it to 48 volt. So where we talked about the cost effectiveness of the technology, of course, what the automakers want, and this is what will spread it like wildfire across, is we get the same questions that we get on everything else, which is, hey, nice first generation, now lower the cost. Mm-hmm. Make it more powerful and make it smaller. And our next generation, which is what we're working on now, actually hits all three. So the technology is going to become more cost-effective and will actually provide even more benefit in terms of fuel economy. The other part of it is in terms of real-world fuel economy, there's one thing to achieve good performance on a test cycle, but hybrids in general perform very well in real-world driving conditions in an urban environment. So where this may deliver somewhere around 5 to 8%, depending on how the system is configured, in a test cycle, you can get somewhere around 15% benefit in urban driving conditions. So at the end of the day, the end user is going to benefit not only from the performance, but also hopefully save some money in the process.
Greg, you've probably driven more cars than anybody here, and a lot of them have had start-stop systems, I'm sure. I mean, so what's your assessment of how these things perform?
So what I think is interesting about stop-start is it seems like it's a little intrusive, even in the best applications right now. So I'm, you know, really excited to see in the new Wrangler and the new Ram just how the system can sort of improve that experience. I think it's something that, you know, the average American consumer doesn't quite get. So I think this could really be a step forward. And, you know, they're two crucial vehicles, too.
And really, the U.S. consumer, when you look globally, we are the most sensitive to drivability. And it's because we're spoiled. 95% of our population drives automatic transmissions.
Sure.
And we demand torque, and we demand it right away and very smooth. And so this ability to restart the engine within 100 milliseconds, you'll feel the difference. And then the fact that the engine speeds up even faster gets you even to a smoother state where you can start applying torque right away and you're moving, you're not waiting. That's why I like to joke around and call it's really an American-sized system.
Mm-hmm. I'm a little curious as well, like how this will impact the Wrangler off-road. That's certainly where a lot of the users will take it.
Yeah.
What's that performance like?
You know, from a transient perspective, the beauty of electric motors is the low-end torque.
Mm-hmm.
So where the engines, particularly as you start looking at turbo applications, you have a little bit of a lag. And that's where the electric machines in general, that's where they thrive, that's where they excel. So you'll have torque, particularly when you're trying to maybe climb some rocks in Moab, and you just want to tip in just a little bit. You can do that all electrically here, and that's where I think you'll notice the performance benefit in those types of even in those types of situations.
But isn't the danger that, I mean, as you're negotiating these rocks, that you may be at a full stop and then it shuts off? I mean, it's just, that'd be a little disconcerting.
You have to feather the throttle.
There you go.
So will these systems, Brian, allow a little bit of pure electric drive, maybe in your neighborhood as you leave the house, or are they capable of that?
You know, in the first configuration where this is on the alternator, we don't expect it to. And the reason why is you have to overcome all the inertial losses of trying to, basically drive this whole engine without fuel causing that detonation and that torque spinning. In the different configurations, when you're talking in a P2 or a P4 application or even a P3, you know, where it's integrated into the transmission, that's definitely possible. But in order to achieve that, we think particularly for the U.S. market, you need more power. And the way you're going to achieve more power is this is an induction machine. Mm-hmm. In the future, our next generation, we're really looking at bringing magnets into play. So at neodymium magnets, we can make this thing more compact and more powerful. And when we do that, we can drive torque. We can drive it anywhere. We can drive it to the crankshaft, or we can drive it through the transmission, or we can drive it to the wheels.
Now, for the consumer, are there any extra maintenance issues with this? I mean, it's driven off of a belt. It's got some hookups for coolant lines and so forth. This is pretty much a life of vehicle, forget it kind of a thing, right?
Absolutely. It'll be completely transparent to the end consumer. They won't know the system is in there unless they can feel it in terms of the NVH, or unless it's got a nice badge, like maybe something like an eTorque, which I think FCA was quite clever with.
Right. So this leads to a question we got from the audience. Jeff from St. Louis, Missouri says, my wife's Lexus Hybrid required special equipment for any major service, so we weren't able to use an independent mechanic. Mm. Do you see this becoming more common with the increased electrification of new vehicles, or will the 48-volt mild hybrids be simple enough for an independent shop to be able to work on?
Yeah, I would say certainly 48-volt falls under the anyone can handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why is from a federal motor vehicle safety standard, they basically set a limit at 60 volts. So below 60 volts, it's safe for anyone to touch. So your common mechanic that doesn't have high voltage training is going to be absolutely okay.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of this is we're not necessarily talking about also high voltage accessories like an air conditioning system or maybe things like a coolant heater. So everything in the system is either going to run on 12 volt or 48 volt, which is intrinsically safe.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get over to high voltage, yes, there is going to be more precautions that are necessary. But frankly, hybrids are coming into the market, and even the mom-and-pop shops are going to get exposed to them. Mm-hmm. And the way the OEMs are approaching that in the future is they're going to look at ways to mechanically protect and make things very simpler. Mm-hmm. So you're going to start seeing integration of power electronic boxes. So things like an onboard charger might get integrated into a DC-DC converter, and they'll actually be coupled in the same box. So when a mechanic sees it, he doesn't have to worry about all these wires going to and from. They know exactly where it is, and they can work, you know, on one side of it or on the other side of it. But if they have to get to these high-voltage boxes, it'll be a little bit more simple because of the more integration we expect in the future.
Mm-hmm. And one more thing about that. I think you said this was the case, but sub-GR77 said, is that starter generator liquid-cooled?
This is our liquid-cooled 48-volt motor generator unit, yes.
Right.
And in this case, but what liquid cooling means is the motor is cooled with coolant as well as the inverter. So mm-hmm. we have both of them. And the reason why this is done is to allow for basically, no nonsense. There's no derating that's required, whether we're at high temperature. The system can tolerate it because it's got cooling of both of those systems. Mm-hmm. So we can basically provide torque whenever the calibrator says they need it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned this possibly being in other configurations. If this, Brian, was in the transmission, it would probably be oil-cooled from that lubricant, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So in a transmission, we're going to want to do one of two things. It's a tight fit. So we want to make it as most compact as possible, and then we have to consider how we're going to put this thing so it's oil-wetted. Mm. And those are the things that that we'll tackle in the next mm-hmm. generations.
And what's the giant cigarette lighter you brought along?
So this is my personal cigarette lighter when I go golfing, mm-hmm. But it also doubles as an electrically heated catalyst. So the idea here is, you know, the U.S. has the toughest emission standards in the world, and I hope we recognize that. We have the cleanest air quality in the world as a result. But we have a challenge. So going from today, 2018, to 2025, vehicles will have to achieve what we call SULEF 30 on average. So that means 30 milligrams per mile of hydrocarbon and nitrous oxides. So it's a significant cut. And additionally, they have to reduce the particulate from 10 milligrams per mile down to 3 milligrams per mile. And in order to achieve that, you actually have to heat the aftertreatment as fast as possible. So heat up the catalyst system. And when you do that, you take these hydrocarbons and you convert them into something that's not harmful anymore. So in order to do that today, you have to burn fuel. And going from 2018 to 2025, you're going to have to burn around 1% of your fuel economy additional to achieve those types of temperatures. And while you're doing that, you're producing emissions. So what this allows us to do is to use the battery system that's inside these hybrid vehicles and use the electricity to basically heat the aftertreatment. Think of it like your blow dryer that's at home. You got heat, and you're blowing some air in. In this case, the air is coming from the engine exhaust. And once it hits this hot surface that's in the front there, we have what we call light-off conditions. So we hit these very high temperatures, 500, 600 degrees Celsius. And now we can convert the emissions down to essentially nothing. And we can provide a real nice pathway to meet these emission compliance.
So these are emissions coming from gasoline engines, not from diesel engines?
So both. So the beauty of the U.S. is we have standards that apply to both, and they're the same. So whether it's emissions coming from a diesel, which are primarily nitrous oxides, or whether they're from gasolines, which are primarily hydrocarbon and CO. So this type of a system, aftertreatments rely on temperature to do their conversion. That's how they work. They have catalysts inside of them. And this allows it to reach those temperatures as fast as possible. So we'll see these certainly first on diesel systems as there's a huge crisis, particularly in Europe. But I wouldn't be surprised if we see these in the U.S. market as well as in China, because China is undergoing a real transformation in their pollution emissions as well. But you'll start seeing these things, not so much on the golf course, unless we can shrink this thing down into a nice package, but in your tailpipe for sure.
And Brian, having 48 volts to a vehicle engineer is like giving them a gift of more electrical power. And I'm thinking things like heating up various elements of the exhaust for lower emissions, but you've also got some power draw coming in from autonomous sensor technology. And I've got to believe that a 48-volt system would be a good thing to have if I'm putting LIDARs and radars and these power-gobbling devices on the vehicle.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. When you look at the stress already on the 12-volt, we call it board net, so what's supplying all these consumers, it's already pretty much tapped because we have nice displays, and yes, we've gone to LEDs, but just more and more and more. As we bring on ADAS functions, the sensors, but more so maybe even the processing elements. So how do you do vision processing? It requires a lot of processing power, and then you generate a lot of heat. We think on a given test run, in real-world driving, you're probably talking about 400 watts of continuous load. And a 48-volt system may actually come in just to solve that problem. Yeah. Not even addressing the CO2, but just providing an additional board net to supply. But there's also other topics. So we talked about utility, and you talked about a Jeep Wrangler being in the middle of, you know, Moab. Well, wouldn't it be nice if I can use that battery to do something interesting for maybe personal consumer use? And so we're actually developing something called a mobile power generator. So I'm in the middle of my campground. I'm in the middle of my, in the middle of a camping trip in Moab, but I want to power whatever, an iron shirt so I can look good on your show. I can actually do that with that type of a system. I can power things like, George Foreman grill. We can do basically any number of things, but the utility, particularly on the trucks, is probably power tools. Mm-hmm. And now we can harness this generator to produce this constant power or use the battery and able to allow us to operate these power tools. So electrification and kind of the American consumer and the utility, they go very well together.
Mm-hmm. Would that be something that the OEM would just make invisible? You would just sell it to them and they'd have that? Or would Continental brand a feature like that?
We see this integrated into the vehicle. We think that's the easiest application versus an aftermarket. So I would see it more being the former, integrating into the vehicle. And certainly, particularly the Detroit 3, they'd love to keep their branding to themselves.
Uh-huh.
Very cool feature, and it's something that's very consumer-centric, consumer-facing. You know, I mean, I can see an off-road enthusiast thinking,
you bet,
you know, this is way cooler on the new Wrangler.
Mm-hmm. So we have another question here from the audience. Shiny Baldy wants to know, what is the future of diesels for consumer vehicles? Will they be paired with a mild hybrid?
Diesel and 48-volt pair very nicely, as does gasoline systems. And really because it provides both the CO2 benefit as well as the tailpipe emissions. But in general, the reason why diesels are going to need a system like this, particularly with an electrically heated catalyst, is they do a lot of idling. And when they do so, the temperature of their exhaust drops pretty quickly, more so than in a gasoline combustion engine. And when it does that, that's where we have a lot of nitrous oxide emissions. And this system, the cigarette lighter, is basically going to turn on, and it's going to keep the system nice and hot. And that way, we're not having to burn fuel, and we're able to keep the nitrous oxide emissions nice and low. So there's more of a need on the aftertreatment side than on the gasoline side. But both benefit from it on the CO2 and on the fuel economy front.
Okay. So we have a phone call, and I'm not sure this is precisely in your ballpark, but you're interested in lots of things, so I'm sure you'll have a good answer for it. So could you bring the phone call in, please?
Yeah, this is Cliff Zorowski in Delmont, Pennsylvania. My question is, has there been a study done to see how much more pollution will be put into the air by the power plants when all these electric cars are plugged into the grid? Thank you. Bye.
So the question is really addressing, we think, a topic that doesn't get brought up enough, which is well-to-wheel emissions. You know, how do we treat an electrified vehicle, particularly a pure battery electric vehicle, in terms of the whole CO2 footprint? And although I think we're more proactive in the U.S., so today a Chevy Bolt would come off the assembly line and would earn 0 grams of CO2 per mile because it's pure battery electric. But in the future, that will actually sunset, and something like a Chevy Bolt will actually have a carbon, call it a penalty, but it'll have to account for the upstream emissions, and around something around like 80 to 85 grams of CO2 per mile. So the U.S. is, I think, kind of leading that. It's on the forefront. We're starting to talk about it. But the answer is complex because of where we think the grid is today. And where we think it's going to be in the future. And I'll give you one of the more complex challenges. If you take a look at Pennsylvania, the Midwest, or something like a Detroit, a lot of our power is still generated from coal. If you look at the West Coast, particularly California, there's a lot of natural gas that's doing a lot of the power of operation. So in Detroit and Pennsylvania, a Ram pickup truck and a 100 kilowatt hour Tesla, the footprint CO2 well to wheel, it's not that far apart, particularly once the Ram adopts a 48 volt system on it. Mm-hmm. When you look at California, it's no contest because of the natural gas. So I think part of the discussion, and as CARB starts looking at post-2025 and the EPA starts looking at post-2025, the question is, will they start adopting a full life cycle type assessment?
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have another phone call. This is in a slightly different direction, so bring that one in.
Hello, this is John in Burlington. Just calling to see if he can elaborate on the multi-injection, direct injection, and multi-port injection. How much complexity does that add to the powertrain? Thank you very much. Great shows. Thank you.
We're certainly seeing a transformation in how we approach injection systems. So conventionally, as the motivation to get to direct injection was twofold. Really, we want to achieve a little bit more power density, but the other motivation for it is it's great for achieving catalyst light-off conditions because we can do multiple injections, we can control the detonation exactly where we want to dose it relative to where the piston is, and we know how to generate heat. And so we can do things like generate heat for the aftertreatment and also, but you have to deal with particulate. That's the negative side of direct injection. So the industry has really looked at how do we resolve this problem. We like one, but we have a penalty. So we're looking at both of the things that were talked about is getting to higher injection pressure. So today we're at 150 bar injection system. We're now looking at 350 bar injection system. And the other one is how do we use the best of both worlds? So how do we marry a port injection system with direct injection? So direct injection, in those cases, would be really looking at this initial start, trying to get the engine as stable as possible, generate as much heat as possible. But then when we go into high load, when we want to tip in and drive away, we'll get into a port injection mode. And the configuration isn't so complex. It's just more hardware. Hmm. So instead of having one set of injectors, you have two, and you have to look at multiple fuel lines, fuel rails, as well as pumps for it. But the benefit is the payoff is seen on the emission side as well as controlling the combustion system. The best part of it, and particularly being on the supplier side, is both of the solutions were great. So there isn't one is necessarily better than the other, but now we want to look at what's the next generation. How does this marry with maybe low temperature combustion or like high octane fuels that can get us to higher compression ratios? And that's where the fun is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're getting to the end here, so you each get one question.
So Brian, it's interesting to hear so much detail coming from the 100-plus-year-old internal combustion engine, both gasoline and diesel. Clearly, we haven't hit the end of our ability to refine this and evolve it. Are you getting a sense from your industry customers that there's a real kind of a balance right now at the automakers in terms of their devotion to going pure electric versus adding 48 volts and new injection systems and turbocharging, et cetera?
The conversation that we have with the traditional combustion people, these are experts that can tell you exactly what the air-to-fuel ratio is at particular temperatures and traditional strokes in the engine. When I sit down with them, they want to talk a little bit about how electrification can solve the little problem that they have. And if electrification can solve that problem, then it opens up a whole new sphere for them to do development work. So the combustion pure development is just transforming. It's not the same, and it's definitely with electrification in mind. But we still have those pure scientists getting to work, focusing on just combustion. How do we get the most combustion? What should the engines look like in the future? But always electrification is going to solve one specific problem. Now I have to look at it in another realm. And then when we start talking about having electrification on board, it's what other accessories can you bring to the table? So we talked about a heated catalyst. We have to talk about an electric turbocharger, a first-stage turbocharger, what we call a compressor, and how that changes the adaptation to it. So from a powertrain perspective, or propulsion, as Dan Nicholson likes to call it, there's more and more to cover. And so it makes my job fun because we get to go develop technology and spend everyone's money to try to come up with the next technology breakthrough to unlock some more from the combustion.
And because you're so interested in so many things.
Absolutely.
Greg.
So we've talked a lot about, you know, the many different functional capabilities of the 48-volt system. I'm kind of curious, just from a pure performance, like, say you were to drop this into, you know, just a sports car, what could this system do to really augment that performance?
You know, in a sports car configuration, you're really talking about very high load, very high acceleration type of performance. And you're probably looking at this from a feature standpoint. You know, how can I take additional components off the accessory drive that were driven mechanically and adding load? So things like a coolant pump, things like my oil pumps, I could start removing those loads by electrifying them. I can provide basically a generator to feed these things, and then I have fewer things that are parasitic losses. When I unlock parasitic losses and I also address the thermal management aspects, now I really unlock more efficiency from the system. So the ability to address those types of topics from a performance standpoint, again, electrification can play a pretty critical role.
Sounds like a lot of fun, I think.
So, Brian McKay, it's been great.
Thank you.
Fascinating stuff and good visual aids. And so we want to thank you very much for coming on the show today. So,
thank you. My pleasure.
Your powertrain knowledge at Continental is quite deep and quite broad, I think we could say.
Thank you. So, thank you very much.
Appreciate it. So, we're going to take a break now and hear from our friends at Bridgestone and Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, and we're back. And that was quite fascinating what
really cool stuff
these guys are up to. You know, I mean, it's one of these interesting things that the suppliers are doing so much technology development. And, you know, we often just think perhaps, you know, oh, the OEM developed this. Isn't this great? You know, and it's guys like Brian and his team that are actually doing that stuff.
Well, I agree, and I also think that with the whole somewhat hype around so many EVs by 2022, by 2021, we forget that there's going to be so many vehicles, really billions of vehicles by 2030 that are still going to have combustion engines right from the factory.
Right.
So, and the evolution is just amazing to me.
Yeah, it's astonishing stuff. So, okay, this is a part of the show, and actually, Greg, you're not familiar with this. Lindsay is, but you're not.
All right.
So it's the Dr. Data section of the show where I come up with a number, and it has to do with the auto industry. It could do anything that has to do with the auto industry, and then you guys need to guess what the number possibly could be.
Okay, all right.
So, Carmen, Katie, whomever, please bring up the number. So you can see it right there. Okay, so this is in 2026 in the United States, there'll be 5 million of whatever this is, and worldwide there will be 20 million of whatever this is.
Electric cars.
I'm going to say autonomous cars.
Damn you, Migliori. Yeah. The answer, please.
Ooh.
Sold.
So look at that. He's the first time he gets it right off the bat. Yeah. So an outfit called Juniper Research says that in 2026 there'll be 5 million autonomous vehicles sold.
I'm not sure I believe that, but
that's,
you know.
I mean, that's the thing that I found to be so astonishing when I saw that number. I mean,
but do they mean with some automated driving systems or a level 4, level 5?
Level 4, level 5.
Yeah.
That's aggressive. That's ambitious.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think I would take the under on that one.
Yeah, I just think that's absolutely huge. I mean,
yeah, that sounds a little optimistic to me.
And you know, you were talking about that on your drive over to the show. So
yeah.
Whether you take that or not.
I don't think I could have gotten here as quickly if I hadn't been in level zero, though, which was just me driving like a maniac.
Yeah.
I was also in level zero. We probably were drag racing down 696 to get here.
Mm-hmm. All right. So there was a thing that happened, which I think is rather astonishing. And this is a topic that I don't think we've had a show for the last 3 years where we haven't talked about Tesla. Okay. Now, Consumer Reports came out on May 23rd, and they did not recommend the Tesla Model 3 because it said its braking performance was worse than the performance of an F-150. And they're saying, you know, so here's a near luxury car, and, you know, it's just got a ridiculous amount from 60 to zero.
What was their number? Do you know?
It was 152 feet, which is...
That's long.
7 feet longer than a Ford F-150, okay? So this is May 23rd that Consumer Reports comes out with this. A week later, Consumer Reports tests it, and it passes because Tesla did an over-the-air update of the software for the braking system, okay? And so now it's down to 133 feet. So here's a car, right, that's sitting in your driveway, and when you parked it, it would take 152 feet to stop. And then when you drive it again, it's 133 feet.
It's like it had the ultimate brake job.
Yeah, I mean,
God gave it a brake job.
So the miraculous brake job, yeah.
So I mean, is this a game changer? I mean, is Musk done something here that is just this side of magic?
It's pretty cool, that's for sure. I mean, but my question is, what about the validation side of things? Like, how do you validate that the car in your driveway actually can stop what they say it stops? To me, it seems like it introduces a lot of questions, that's mm-hmm. for sure.
And was this the same car? They didn't swap the car. They just did an OTA on it, is that right?
But I mean, this is for all of the Model 3s. This isn't for Consumer Reports Model 3. And so Consumer Reports basically, you know, they tested it again, and that's what the number they got. So I'm sure that, you know, somebody didn't sneak over to...
I got to tell you, Gary, I am in kind of, I won't say denial mode on any news coming out of Tesla, but Musk has done himself no favors over X amount of time, you know, being combative with analysts, and the company hasn't delivered on production of the Model 3, which is really the biggest error there. And the cars continue. They still have problems, you know, with autopilot running into a police car recently, this kind of thing. I won't say that this was a setup, but it's really 20 feet in braking is a remarkable delta. I mean, that's enormous. It's almost like the first time it didn't have pads in the front calipers, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden it does now.
Right.
And you wonder, I mean, this is good news for them, and their stock went up immediately on this news. It went up like 2%. So, don't call me a skeptic with this, but it just, that's really quite remarkable.
So this is interesting. So Jake Fisher, who is the guy at Consumer Reports who tests the vehicles, and he says, you know, he's tested like 1,000 vehicles in this time in his life, and he's never seen anything like this happen. And he had an hour-long interview with Musk. And after that interview, Fisher said, quote, "What's clear is that he's listening and they're trying to make this car better." Now, doesn't that sort of, you know, like run up against the whole thing of he isn't listening and he's just saying, you know, I don't want to hear from you. That's a stupid question.
And, well, it does. And you wonder how many people at Tesla and his advisors are telling him, look, we've had a lot of rough sailing over the last pretty much this year. Maybe we need something that's really going to kind of change that. And I think to a certain degree, you know, he still has people waiting for cars and he still can't make his production, his weekly production numbers. So this was good news for him. I'm not sure this was a PR crusade, but whether somebody concocted this, it just seems a little wild to me.
What I think is also kind of weird, though, is what about all the people who've, you know, actually gotten the car, which isn't all that many, but you just had basically poor braking for as long as you own the car, and then he waves his magic wand and the braking's 20 feet better. Yeah. Like, that's not really fair to the consumer. Like, why not? What, you know, it seems like you're almost endangering people by, you know, putting out an inferior braking product.
Yeah, I guess the question is a good point from Greg. Why did it take this consumer report test for them to do this? And why weren't they looking at, I mean, 20 feet difference, 150 feet is really poor for something like this. Why weren't they looking at cars that were already in customer use? And why didn't this come earlier?
So it's a very good point. But I guess you might make the argument that it was acceptable performance from in terms of braking. I mean, it's how many people brake from 60 to zero ever? I mean, besides us, right?
I do that twice a day.
Yeah, I know.
You know,
I mean,
that's what
I'm
are you talking about, Gary? I mean, yeah.
And right. but short of us, I'm not so sure that's all that frequent. You know, another thing that came out this week was Bloomberg reported the possibility that there's going to be some changes at FCA, that it's quite possible that the plan that Sergio Marchionne is going to go forward with is to take Jeep and Ram, e-torque systems, and you know, roll them out to more markets in the world. I mean, Jeep is pretty much doing that now. I mean, there's lots of Jeeps everywhere, and I don't think there's many Rams, but you know, I don't imagine there's too much of a...
There's not many places to sell Ram other than
right.
North America.
And that they'd combine Alfa Romeo and a Maserati into a single division in Fiat's financial report. Now, I don't know if that just means in their financial reporting, whether it would be one unit, and maybe it would be possibility of spinning it off like Ferrari, but I'll let you guys decide on that. And then the Fiat brand would go down to the 500 and Panda families of vehicles, in that in markets where the vehicles weren't selling well, the Fiat vehicles weren't selling well, that they might pull out of those markets. And one of the markets where we know the 500 isn't selling very well is in the U.S. market.
The one we're standing on isn't this one.
In this
interesting,
one.
Yeah.
So, what do you guys think?
Well, it's interesting. Earlier today, I saw a Fiat 124 Spider. And you know how when you see a car that we've all been to the launches of these cars, but you see something you haven't seen for a while, it's like, well, I forgot they were even doing this, you know? And, you know, and the little utility that they've done off of the off of that global platform is kind of a beefed up 500. It's, you know, it's got high ground
clearance.
500X. You don't see them every day. Now, obviously, you probably see more of both of these cars in the coasts than you do here in Michigan. But it just reminded me that...
I need to see.
I can't think here locally in Metro Detroit, which is Carland, where the nearest Fiat dealer is to us right here in Nova.
Fiat Studio? I mean, that's why you're looking for a dealer, and it's...
It's a studio. It's, yeah, they serve you espressos.
Yeah, I know.
And we're in the wrong place.
Like, I know where I could buy a Ducati. I know where I could buy some Italian shoes. I don't know where I could buy Fiat in this area. And I think that's probably, you know, on the front burner for them is what they do for the Fiat brand in this, you know, in North America. Is it really taken on? I'm seeing more Alfa Stelvios on the road, and whether they've got a deal on them or not, but their utility. And they're just not getting the traction for that.
So Greg, you've undoubtedly driven every Fiat, every flavor, as well as the Alphas and so on. I mean, why do they not seem to be resonating in the U.S. market?
I think the issue is a little bit of brand recognition. I think the average either, like, regular consumer or enthusiast doesn't quite get it. I think, obviously, with Alfa and Maserati, you've got these, you know, great Italian names with this racing heritage. But then you get in them, and are they great to drive? Sure, absolutely. The Giulia is an awesome car, but it has some pretty big shortcomings, too. Like, it uses essentially a proprietary Alfa infotainment system. And I don't really think the world's asking for that. Like, just put Uconnect in that thing, and suddenly that car is immediately competitive with, you know, Mercedes and BMW and Cadillacs in that performance realm.
Good point.
So I feel like they're kind of stubbing their toes with those two brands. Mm. And then with Fiat, it's kind of like, right now that segment does not really, you know, the small car segment is not what consumers want. Mm-hmm. I mean, gas prices are a little higher now, but they're still relatively cheap. So to me, that's something that maybe they should scale back, actually, and then focus on, you know, more crossovers and things of that, you know. And frankly, when you look at the Fiat Chrysler sort of empire, I'm more concerned about the Chrysler, like as in Chrysler brand. Like right now they have like two vehicles, basically, the Pacifica and the 300.
Yeah.
And I mean, to me, there's more opportunity there to maybe add a crossover. You know, maybe it's similar to something that, you know, Jeep makes, and you could get that kind of luxury shine on it. You know, and I'm spitballing here, but to me, that's a brand that they can make more more headway with in the United States.
With Chrysler.
With Chrysler brand, yeah.
So this sort of goes to a question Mike in San Francisco says, is Sergio Marchionne following the lead of Ford by possibly killing off Fiat and Chrysler while concentrating on Jeep with more trucks, SUV, and CUV, since the profit margin for cars is small compared to the CUV? So, I mean, okay, let's take this Chrysler idea. Mm-hmm. Now, would you think that you'd keep the minivan and get rid of the sedan and then put something in there like, an Aspen?
I mean, I believe they may have tried that play once or twice before. I actually think they should definitely build off the minivan and the 300. I think there's still a market for the 300. It's a very old car, but it's still pretty competitive. They still sell some critical mass there.
Yeah.
And then just maybe add a couple of different crossovers in there, things like that. Maybe not a true wagon, but, I mean, it seems like there's opportunities for Chrysler to sort of expand the Chrysler brand. And I think they're leaving money on the table by only giving it a couple of vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you forget, we talk about old cars when you see a Chrysler 300. But as Greg said, I mean, it's a fantastically robust platform. It's still a big, hunkin', real American kind of car, V8 engine, rear drive.
Mercedes?
It was the old E-Class. Maybe three generations ago.
Bavarian.
Yeah, E-Class platform. I mean, the mechanicals are paid for. You know, what happens to Chrysler? It's a great question, really.
So the thing, you know, I wonder about is, remember when there was Daimler Chrysler and it was the, you know, alleged merger of equals, and that Chrysler was the crown jewel of, you know, American vehicles? I mean, what happened?
Two different ownership groups, you know. I think Cerberus, I think Daimler, I think they kind of lost their way, you mm-hmm. know, with the Chrysler brand specifically.
Mm-hmm. It's been an oddity, you know. Jeep was a global brand as soon as World War II was done. We left hundreds of thousands of Jeeps everywhere. It was like immediate marketing and product position in Europe, et cetera. And then the company retreated over various owners and really didn't spread the goodness of Jeep. And now they're kind of getting back into that. It's the only global car brand that FCA has, really. True global. I mean, Fiat somewhat, South America, Europe, basically Italy in Europe for Fiat. But Jeep is kind of known everywhere. Mm. So I can see them leveraging that. But there's also a big push. You know, they got into hybridization and electrification very late. And so what do they do with that? And they stripped a lot of engineers out of the company, basically left the company in 2008, 2009. So they don't have that good base of electrification engineering. And I'm mm-hmm. told that the shareholders are pushing him to put that, in terms of the future plan, put that back on the table.
I'll be really curious to see how the Alfa Maserati side of things plays out as well. I think, you know, we're on the eve, literally, of the five-year plan, the new five-year plan. And to me, it seems like they overreached with those, with the previous five-year plan. You know, each was going to get huge. They get all these different cars. I don't think you need to do that. Just give each of them two or three really good ones, jack up the prices, and do it that way. Don't necessarily worry about the scale.
So we got Wright Knight 70, must be a different Wright Knight, says they will kill Dodge first thing.
I hope not. It seems like that would be not the right move.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at it from a North American perspective. Dodge is pretty much unknown anywhere else.
Right.
That's the issue with Dodge.
Mm-hmm.
I still call Rams Dodges.
Right.
So.
And Levante A says FCA needs to kill the 2.4 multi-air engine.
Doesn't seem like something they need to really lose a lot of sleep over, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not a great engine, but it's versatile.
Yeah.
Does he like Levantes? I mean, that's...
I don't know. And before, so to go back to Tesla a little bit, Joey's cleaning lady says, regarding Tesla, Can you name one Detroit OEM that has a waiting list like the Tesla Model 3?
Name a model, a Detroit model that has a waiting list?
Mm-hmm.
I can't.
What about the GT500? Does that have a waiting list? I'm spitballing. I don't know. Or maybe the Ford GT.
What's important about that question, though? I mean, okay. I mean,
well, I think that, you know, you go to the point of that here's a vehicle that people want so badly that they're willing to place a fully refundable, but still place a deposit down. And there's like 400,000 of these people. And I mean, I think that's one of the phenomenon that we've seen about Tesla that, I mean, to his credit, I mean, you know, you mentioned the Mustang. I mean, I imagine that once upon a time, you know, that there was a certain sparkle and allure of the Mustang where people would line up outside of a dealership to go get a Mustang or to look at a Mustang.
1964 and a half. That happened.
I mean, and that's the whole thing. I mean, it's just like, and this is, I mean, this is one of the things that I think that Detroit has sort of missed a beat on in terms of making something that is sufficiently alluring to customers that, you know, they're willing to line up. I mean, when that car was you know, revealed, it was on the front page of the New York Times.
I agree. I give Musk so much credit. I mean, this is really an American success story. Mm-hmm. We forget that he's an American automaker. He's taken a lot of brickbats. I think some of that X100,000 of waiting names is they're buying into Elon. They're buying into, you know, beyond Elon is SpaceX, and beyond Elon is Model S, which was a real hit. I mean, it's the Tesla aura that people are buying into. Mm-hmm. I know two people that have already canceled their reservations. One guy sold his stock in the company, just doesn't believe in it anymore.
Right.
And recently we saw, you know, complete teardown up at Monroe's on this car, and there's a lot to like, there's a lot not to like when you really break the car down. So I hope they succeed. I mean, I hope they can get it together.
Mm-hmm. All right, moving on to something different. So this is sort of interesting. The SoftBank Vision Fund will invest $2.25 billion in GM Cruise Holdings, further strengthening the company's plans to commercialize automated vehicle technologies at a large scale. And once this closes, then GM will invest $1.1 billion in it. I don't understand why they're waiting for it to close.
It's just pocket change, you know, between the cushions.
But, you know, the thing is, so SoftBank. So I looked into what is SoftBank. SoftBank is basically a Japanese telecommunications company that owns Yahoo Japan. It owns, you know, phone systems. And so last year, I'm going to destroy his first name, and I apologize for that in advance. Masayoshi's son, that little son is his last name, who's the chairman and CEO of SoftBank Group Corp. He said, this is a letter to shareholders. This is part of it. He says, quote, "My own heart is set on a bigger goal, to shake up the world. I want to smash the status quo through the power of the information revolution." And he goes on to talk about that, and this sounds like a science fiction movie. "Until now, human beings have been the most intelligent living thing on Earth, and we have made use of this intelligence. I am certain, however, that within this century, artificial intelligence will overtake human intelligence at a point referred to as the singularity. This will be the greatest paradigm shift in the history of humankind. The coming of the singularity will redefine every industry, opening up new business opportunities for existing industries while also creating new industries."
It's a heck of a shareholder letter.
I mean,
you know what I think of when I hear this term, the singularity? I think of that scene in that Will Smith movie where the robots, everything was kind of robotized and everybody had personal robots to cook and so forth. But there was this evil force that was transforming the robots into a robot army. And there was a scene where the bad robots came into town and the side of this truck rolls up and they're all robot soldiers. And so the singularity had happened then. And all of a sudden, artificial intelligence was kind of at a human level and there was a war going on. Mm-hmm. And I mean, what this is there's more money in the world for investment than we can imagine. And there's so much of it going into artificial intelligence, machine learning, and all of the companies that automakers are buying into right now and partnering with to optimize their own ride-sharing systems, their autonomous vehicle technologies. They can't do it alone. There's a lot of money coming into the, you know, is it going to be there tomorrow? I don't know.
So, I mean, what is this serious amount of money that SoftBank is investing in GM Cruise Automation? Now, they're talking about having autonomous fleet 2019, right? That is going to be used in like livery service. I mean, we're not going to go out and buy one of these things. Do you guys think it's going to happen?
I think there's a lot of efforts. Recently, I interviewed Ken Washington, who's the head of the CTO at Ford, and I mean they're on a similar path in terms of aggressiveness in this area. And I think the first thing we're going to see is in this autonomous revolution is very simple geofenced operation at airports. You know, you'll get the robotic shuttle bus from the blue lot to the Delta terminal, and that'll give us all confidence that we've ridden in one for 3/4 of a mile and we didn't crash, and oh, I've been in one of these things. And the technology implementation will increase on kind of a stepped level. And I think it's going to happen
isn't
within
it sort
the
of like one of those rides at Disney World where you just sort of.
Except it's not on rails or tracks. It's,
yeah, but you don't see those rails or tracks.
Yeah.
They're very cleverly disguised.
The infrastructure is there.
The thing about this investment is there's just a ton of money that's being plowed into this space. To reach the singularity.
What I think is interesting is that this fund that heretofore most of us have never heard from is putting all of this money into this, which is twice as much as GM is actually putting into the Cruise system. It seems odd to me, you know? It's this whole arrangement, I think, is interesting and a little bit bizarre.
So I wonder, I mean, so they'll end up, so SoftBank Vision Fund will end up owning 19.6% in GM Cruise as a result of this, okay? So 20% of the company will be owned by these guys. You know, what I sort of wonder about is this validating what General Motors is doing, or is this validating General Motors' lucky purchase of Cruise Automation? And so what Ford bought, Argo AI.
Argo AI, right,
and,
right.
It's like, damn, I wish I would have bought Cruise instead of Argo.
I think GM really does come out looking smart in this. Like, they showed a lot of foresight when they went ahead with this purchase. I think at the time, I was very like, what are they doing? You know, this is such a far-off bet. Is it ever going to pay off? And I mean, it literally just did pay off and to the tune of $2.5 billion.
Right.
Yeah, I agreed. We'll have to see where it goes, though.
All right, a final thing, and then we'll end up the show. I thought this was rather astonishing. So this is in the UK. Volvo has joined forces with delivery service Amazon Prime to offer test drives of the Volvo V40 this summer. So basically what you do is if you're in the UK, in London, Birmingham, Manchester, Edinburgh, you can go through your Amazon Prime hookup. They'll come to your house and do a test drive with the V40, and they'll spend, you know, 30, 40 minutes with you and driving around. Is this the future of car buying? Is this the way it's going to happen? Will Amazon completely transform that the way they have transformed, you know, the buying of books and music and everything else?
I think, yeah. I mean, just as someone who uses Prime a lot for things I don't even need, just the ease of it is there, you know?
Right.
I really think this could be a smart play.
Right. You sit there and you say, I haven't bought anything from them in 24 hours. Right. How about a car?
Right. No, but I mean, it's sort of interesting, though. I mean, you have this personalization that is you know, for you. I mean, and you're not necessarily having to go to a dealer. I mean, clearly, the franchise laws that exist in the United States are undoubtedly different than they are in the UK, where they're doing this now. But I mean, I just wonder whether we're going to come to, you know, a singularity, and it will transform the whole retail experience of cars.
I think, you know, abroad is where we're going to see this happen first, because the franchise laws are so tight, so restrictive here in the U.S.
Yeah.
I don't think we're going to see a lot of innovation for at least 5-10 years. You know, who knows, maybe ever. Changing those laws that vary state by state could be really a tough thing. But in the UK, where obviously it's all's fair, you know, I think you're going to see some pretty cool consumer models.
I'd love to hear how UK-based Volvo dealers are reacting to this. Mm-hmm. You know, Amazon's a very respected brand, and a lot of people, me included, I feel uncomfortable going into a car dealership, even though we're in the business.
Right.
I love to spar with these guys, but somebody could just drive up my driveway, give me a great walk around about the car. I might be inclined to ink a deal then.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing about Amazon and services like that is just the simplicity, the ease of use.
Right.
Like, you're looking up, you're like, dog chews. Okay, 38 ounces for, you know, the long ones that taste like pork. Maybe it's a dollar more than Walmart, but it's going to come here in 2 days, and I just have to swipe, and it's here. I mean, that's appealing for a car.
Yeah.
Car buying experience.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's a revolutionary time.
Yeah, which is great. So I want to thank you both for being here today. Greg McGillioray.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
Autoblog.com. It's a great site. Check it out.
Yeah.
Lindsay Brook, Automotive Engineering. And
thanks for having me.
Find that at SAE.org.
Correct.
Then go in there deeply. And then
you're lost. You're completely lost.
Somewhere you'll find Lindsay's stuff that's really worthwhile.
Right.
And, it was good fun having Brian McKay on.
Good show. Great job as moderator, too.
Yeah. So, anyway, want to thank you all for tuning in today, and we'll be back next week. So, thank you.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily news fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at AutoLine.tv.